actually kept in mind Ernest Cline the whole time because I don't think he has any tech experience either. And I was like, if this white man can do it, let me sit down and write this book with confidence.
Welcome to Talking Simulator, a series of short conversations about video games with interesting people who play them. I'm Jordan Erica Weber, and in this episode, I discuss fictional games with my guest, Brittany Morris.
Hi, my name is Brittany Morris. I'm the author of Slay, The Cost of Knowing, and most recently, Marvel's Spider-Man, Miles Morales, Wings of Fury.
Brittany's book, Slay, is about a teenager called Kira, who creates a virtual reality, massively multiplayer online video game, inspired by Wakanda and designed as a secret safe space for her and other black players. After an upsetting event in the real world throws an unwanted spotlight on her game, Kira suddenly has a crisis on her hands. But don't worry if you haven't read it. We won't reveal how it all plays out. Instead, I wanted to ask Brittany about the process of creating this fictional game and what it was like to go on to work on real video games, like Subnautica Below Zero. I really enjoyed this interview and am so grateful to Brittany for her time, especially because she was, at the time of recording, 9 months pregnant. I am so glad that you were able to talk to me, especially considering the fact that you are about to have a baby, because I have wanted to interview since I read Slay way back at the beginning of this year, which honestly feels like about a decade ago at this point.
It does.
I saw people recommending it on Goodreads and I just kind of picked it up thinking, like, how many books are there about video games? But for the sake of people listening who haven't read it, how would you summarize Slay? What's the kind of elevator pitch?
So Slay is about a 17-year-old game developer who creates a Wakanda-inspired virtual reality video game called Slay. And after someone is murdered in real life over a dispute in the game, she has to duel a racist troll using duel cards based on black culture and black history.
Slay is your first published novel, so I presume that it's the story that you were burning to write. That seems to be the way that things go with authors' first books, right? Like, it's the one that was kind of in your heart that you needed to get out there. So where did the idea for it come from?
Great question. So I was inspired to write it after I saw Black Panther on opening night a couple years ago. And so the inspiration actually kind of goes all the way back to my childhood. Growing up, I was the only black kid at my school, one of three, I think, in my hometown, Corvallis, Oregon. And so in elementary school, I kind of became like the resident black culture expert. Like, all the kids expected me to be able to explain how my hair worked and like know the right types of music and have eaten the right foods and be up on the times with all things black culture and be able to explain it to them. And I was like, oh my God, why do I feel unqualified to be black? This doesn't make any sense. Like, and so my whole life, like, I kind of lived in this like weird racial limbo, like thinking I was too black for my white friends and too white for my black friends. And it was a mess. And I really didn't confront this like identity issue until well into adulthood. And I went natural with my hair. I stopped using relaxers. I started just wearing my hair as it grows out of my head. And so I really had to confront, like, who I am as a black woman. And, like, walking into that theater was the very first time that I allowed myself to feel total love and acceptance from the black community. Like, I wasn't sitting there critiquing myself. I wasn't sitting there saying, oh my God, do I sound too white? You know, am I code switching? Like, all this stuff. It was just enough to cross my arms, say Wakanda forever. And that was it. And I was in. And I was accepted. And I was like, this is the best thing ever. And so I left the theater wanting that feeling back. I was like, I have got to go back to Wakanda, where if you're black, you're incredible, and that's the end of the story. And so I kept hoping somebody would make like a Wakanda simulator video game or like a Black Panther video game. And I think 3 days went by where I was like viscerally upset that nobody was talking about this. Like, it wasn't anywhere on social media. I was like, why is nobody talking about making a Black Panther video game? I need this. And so I said, if I don't know how to make one, a video game, I'm going to write about a book about a person who does. And so that was where Kira's story was born.
Amazing. And that's kind of what I want to talk about mostly, is this, the idea of designing a game when you're not a person who makes games, designing a fictional game for a fictional world. I guess the main question is, how do you go about doing that? How do you go about coming up with an entire fictional video game, especially one that you're going to build an entire plot around?
Great question. So there was a lot of imposter syndrome to get over. Like, I've always loved video games, but I've never been on like the creation side of them, not even in, with writing. So at the time of writing Slay. So there was a lot of like, oh my God, I'm totally unqualified to talk about anything related to coding. Like, I don't know anything about web development. I don't know anything about servers or, you know, how game characters work. I don't know anything about rendering, nothing. So I was like, I've just got to roll with it. I've just got to do it. And I actually kept in mind Ernest Cline the whole time because I don't think he has any tech experience either. And I was like, if this white man can do it, let me sit down and write this book with confidence. And so that was the energy that I brought with me. So yeah, so I just had fun with it. And a lot of the elements in Slay are like totally unrealistic for 2020. Like, the fact that, you know, in the book, there are two teenage girls running this MMORPG game where everybody is on, you know, six servers and like everybody's characters are loading perfectly. All their weapons, there's like no glitches. Like everything runs super smoothly. Like just, it's like VR chat, but like if there were no errors, like that doesn't exist. People aren't going to get VR equipment from garage sales. Somebody does in the book. That's not happening in 2020. It's still very expensive. So tech-wise, it's very forward. It's maybe 10, 20 years in the future. But I figured, you know, 10, 20 years ago, teenagers weren't really making many games in their room at all, let alone VR worlds. And so I said, well, in 10 to 20 years, maybe, you know, VR games will just be run-of-the-mill and everybody will have made one and it'll be, you know, your freshman computer science major project. So, yeah.
Ernest Cline aside, have you got any favorite examples of other fictional games?
Warcross, definitely. By Marie Lu.
I don't think I know what that is.
Oh, it's so good. So I read it after I wrote the first draft of Slay. Before I went back and edited, and I tend to do that. I tend to write a draft and then read a book that's similar to the book I just wrote and then go back and edit what I've written, because that's when I'm able to be like, oh, this could all be better, or I'm glad I didn't do that. And so I read Warcross by Marie Lu and I was like, this is amazing. The action's incredible. There's romance in this one that like romance is not like my forte. So I took notes from that. It's so, so good. It's about I think she's Chinese. Her name is Amika Chen. She has rainbow hair. She has this like hoverboard, like in real life, like it's set in the future. And in this game, it's like an augmented reality game. So in like people can put on these glasses and they like see different things. And with how people are, you know, dressed in big cities and everything, it reminded me of the Capitol and the Hunger Games. So people have like these crazy outfits and they have like imaginary pets and it's really cool. And there's this game called Warcross, and she accidentally hacks into like the game during like a major tournament. And so they bring her in to compete. And then the whirlwind just continues from there. It's a ride. I love that book. Marie Lu is amazing.
That's so cool. One of the key features of the game in Slay is these ability cards that the characters use. Could you give me some examples of those? What are your favorites?
Absolutely. So I had a lot of fun with the cards. There are so many like food related ones. I love food so much. there's a card in there called Mom's Mac and Cheese, and it will pin your opponent to the ground because good luck trying to fight anyone on a full stomach of mac and cheese. Oh, there's one called the representation card, which will triplicate you. So there will be three of you. And I actually took inspiration from a show that I used to watch when I was little called Code Lyoko. That was my first like introduction to like a virtual reality world involving teenagers. And they like sneak away on their lunch break and like go into this virtual space and have to battle this evil computer named Xana. And one of them in the game has the power to triplicate himself. So there's three of him. And I thought, that sounds like a representation of representation and what it means and how important it is in the Black community, in any community, actually. So that's one of my favorites. There's a card in there called the Jay's card, which is the rarest card in the game. And it will boost your jumping ability by 70%. The shuffle card is the fun one. It scrambles your opponent's cards into any round. So even though they've had the same amount of time at the beginning of the game to plan out their attack strategy, if you use a shuffle card in the first round, all their cards scramble. And so they're like, I got to use whatever, whenever. Oh, God. So the game could take a hard left or a hard right at any time with that one. So, yeah, those are some of my favorites.
When it came to writing the cards, did you have a lot of the ideas already in mind, or did you do research?
A lot of them I had in mind. So I was actually rushing to write the first draft of Slay because Pit Mad was coming up, a Twitter pitch contest, and I really wanted to have a finished manuscript in time, because that's one of the rules of participation. You need a finished book. So I wrote the first draft in 11 days.
Bloody hell!
Yeah, I don't recommend people do that. It was really terrible. I came down with the flu on day 12. Like, I didn't sleep. I didn't eat. My husband barely saw me. Like, you basically have to abandon all sense of self-preservation if you're going to crank out a book in 11 days. I do not recommend people try that. And I certainly don't recommend that they query 2 days later.
And crunch is supposed to be bad in video games.
So I wrote it very, very fast. And so the first time I was thinking about the cards, it was really just a matter of me sitting down and going, okay, Brittany, quick, just rapid fire list all of the different, like, inside jokes that you've had with people on Black Twitter. Like, think back to your childhood, think back to all the hairstyles you've ever had, think back to all the foods that you've ever eaten with your family, think back to, you know, all of the Black colloquialisms that you've ever heard of. Think of all the Black icons that, you know, make you that much prouder to be who you are. And so it was just me listing a whole bunch of different things. And then from there, I would think of different, like, powers that the cards had, depending on the name and the meaning. And so I think I came up with the original list of cards in, like, a couple hours. And then from there, they just kind of evolved, and we brought in more cards, and yeah.
Have you got a list then, separate from the ones that are in the book?
Actually, I think all of them made it into the book. I think I came up with 42 cards, and I think they all made it into the book. The one I forgot, though, that I'm kicking myself for is Sweet Potato Pie. So if there's ever a Slay sequel, that will be in there.
When you were designing the game and coming up with these cards and everything, were you thinking about whether the game would be playable in real life and how much fun it would be? Because obviously you are someone who plays video games, so that must have run through your mind.
Yeah, I was. I don't really play online games or VR games, actually. I mostly play console and PC. But yeah, the whole time I was like, how cool would it be to just step into a space like this and just be able to, like, challenge someone to a duel and be like, here we go. And just see this whole deck of cards that, like, encapsulates a major part of your culture. Like, it would just be so much fun.
So let's talk about the VR aspect then, because that's obviously quite key to the game. What made you decide to make it a virtual reality game?
Probably a little bit of desiring escapism. I think wanting to step back into Wakanda and be in the game with a controller, it just didn't feel as, like, immersive. I really had this vision of Kira standing there in the middle of this arena. You can probably blame my obsession with Avatar and The Legend of Korra on that. But I had this vision of her just standing in the middle of this giant arena surrounded by all things Black culture. And, you know, I was like, we're going to need a VR space for that.
I ask because a line that really struck me in the book was, I don't think they make a headset in the world big enough to fit Dad's head. And I wondered if that was a reference to the fact that virtual reality headsets tend not to be designed with Black hair in mind.
Ooh, it wasn't, but that's a very good point. Like, I tend to, any kind of headwear, like, I tend to buy Black because they seem to be the only people thinking of those things. Like, this turban that I'm wearing right now has a drawstring, so it can go bigger if I need it to.
It seemed to me that the main question that the book was asking was about the role of safe spaces. Is that a fair interpretation?
Absolutely.
Okay, so without spoiling the plot, I guess, can you talk about how you use this virtual world, this VR game, to explore the idea of safe spaces and to ask questions around that?
Absolutely. So the idea for this book really started off as what would happen if there was a Wakanda simulator, an all-black video game, or a video game that was specifically dedicated to celebrating the kaleidoscopic experience of global blackness. And then the natural follow-up question kind of became, who would have a problem with the existence of this game? And so I started thinking of, you know, just all the different angles people could come at this game, analyzing why it exists, who's allowed in, who's not allowed in, you know, what was the motivation behind Kira's creation of the game. And I got way more questions coming to my head than I really anticipated. Like, you've got, in the book, you've got the news, who's obviously, you know, they're going to take the... They're going to take, like, the kind of archaic questions about, like, oh my god, do video games cause violence? As if violence hasn't been around since well before video games. They're going to, you know, ask, is it, like, an online gang? Is it, like, a hub for, like, anti-white racism? Like, I could just see them asking that on the news, depending on the news station. I could also see people, you know, well-meaning black people coming out and saying, is this actually hurting the situation because it's a video game, or should we be encouraging our youth to stay in school and focus on their studies? Like, there's a lot of, like, video game phobia among parents. And, like, I get it. Like, I'm about to be a parent. There's a lot of scary stuff in gaming. But there's also a lot of, like, incredible things. Like, some of the most incredible stories I've ever taken in have been from video games. And so there's a parent in the story who, well, he's an uncle. He's very much a father figure to his nephews. And he's even wrestling with, okay, this game is about also learning black history. Like, let's not throw, you know, the baby out with the bathwater. There's some good stuff in here. But also, I'm kind of nervous to, like, just let my nephews explore this online escape. So there's so many different angles that people are coming at this game with, and it opens up a broader discussion about safe spaces and who needs them. And a couple of Kira's white friends are like, well, why can't I, you know, play the game? I don't understand why it's just for black people. And I've had people ask me that if Slay was a real game, would I prevent white people from playing it? The real answer is you can't. People will get in. People will, you know, get passcodes. It's just there's no way to block that. But my question is, why do you need to? Like, if you feel the need to join this game, you probably don't understand why it exists. It's for people who feel that need to perform when they're in, like, a majority white space. And it happens to everybody. Like, it doesn't matter how, you know, close your friends are. It doesn't matter how long you've known these people. If you're in a majority white space, you know you have to at least keep it in the back of your mind that you could make people uncomfortable with some of the stuff that you say, or just elements of who you are, elements of your culture. You just know intuitively you kind of have to, maybe not dial it back, but you have to know how to dial it back in case things get out of hand. So just not having to be on is a huge, huge benefit of having a safe space like that. Just being able to breathe and relax and just be yourself without judgment. It's so, so important. So the book talks about all of those things. It's a very, very big book in 300 pages.
One character that I found particularly interesting was the boyfriend. Now, you mentioned earlier that you're not really a romance person, but you wrote this boyfriend for her, and he turns out to be a fascinating character. How did you come up with him, and what role does he serve in the story?
Good question. So I've seen a lot of black men like him, especially on Instagram, who have these pro-black ideals that are at least bumping up against, if not, like, full on in bed with anti-whiteness or anti-everybody else-ness. And I think that was an important distinction to make, is that Slay is extremely pro-black. It's celebrating all things black. You know, it's saying, like, if you are black, you're in, whatever your gender, whatever your, you know, your shade, whatever, all these other things that have been an issue or topic of discussion in the black community. And Malcolm, the boyfriend, was extremely preoccupied with boxing everyone else out and even boxing out some of his own people. So he would bring up topics like, you know, the black nuclear family, the black heteronuclear family. And he would uphold that ideal as like the pinnacle of black success and black excellence. And he would be like, you know, black dad, black mom, everybody has natural hair. Mom doesn't wear makeup because she knows her worth. Yikes. you know, they have 2.5 black kids and they live in a non-gentrified majority black neighborhood. And anything besides that is like, you know, tearing down the pillars of the black community. And it, for him, that includes video games. Like, he hates the idea of, quote, distractions in the black community from education and the traditional life route with the white picket fence and the dog and the cat and all that. So that kind of ideal is holding us back, I feel, in a lot of different ways and a lot of different dimensions. Malcolm has a borderline, just visceral hatred of white people. And I wanted to put Kira's ideals and, you know, philosophies and opinions up against that to show what Kira is not. So I knew if I didn't include a character like that, people might read this book and go, yeah, so Kira is anti-white and it's, you know, it's pretty obvious. Well, no, it's really not. This is what anti-white looks like. I've seen it. It's very ugly and not condoned in the world of Slay. So I thought that was an important distinction.
I hadn't realized that that was kind of the point of his character. I think from my perspective, obviously as a white reader, I was thinking how great it was that this book just had multiple black characters who disagreed about how they should talk about their blackness around white people and that kind of thing. I didn't realize that he was there to kind of make Kira seem less extreme, probably also to white readers, let's be honest.
I mean, it's kind of both. Once I created Kira's character, all the other characters bouncing their opinions off of her kind of took on their own shades and everything. And Steph, Kira's sister, one of my favorite characters, she and Malcolm are very, very closely aligned with like how much they take pride in being black, but they have very, very different conclusions on what that means for their lives. So Steph is like, read everything, take in everything, check your facts, check your sources, make sure you got your ducks in a row. Like, she's on the debate team. And Malcolm is like, only take in, you know, black authors and, you know, people who lift up black authors and, you know, ignore anybody else because they don't have our best interests at heart. He creates his own echo chamber in a way. So yeah, they're very close in ideologies, but they're very, very different in conclusions. So, I mean, that's why Harper's question at the very beginning of the book, here's white friend Harper, when she asks, am I allowed to wear dreadlocks? By the end of the book, you realize just how complicated of a question that is and how if Harper asked anyone else in the book, it would be a different answer every single time.
Since writing Slay, you have ended up writing for real-world video games like Subnautica, which is a game that I love.
Aww.
What has that been like?
It's been amazing. I have had so much fun. I started out writing a video game for Redwall that is not out yet with Soma Games. And then I moved on to Subnautica Below Zero. And, I mean, I've been a huge fan of Subnautica since, I think, 2016, when the first one was out and Jacksepticeye was playing it. I used to be a huge Jacksepticeye stan, so I, like, watched all of his videos, and I was a huge fan of Subnautica. So when they reached out to me and they said, oh, there's, you know, a new sci-fi video game coming out and it stars a black woman, I was like, I'm in. And then they were like, yeah, so it's this game called Subnautica Below Zero. And I, like, almost fell out of my chair. I was, like, you know, running to grab my husband. I was like, you won't believe who's talking to me right now. It's the team behind Subnautica. I'm freaking out. But once I got over my, like, you know, starstruckness and joined the team and was able to, like, coherently form a sentence, we got so much done. I was working with two other writers, Zaire Linier and Jill Murray, who has worked on huge projects like Assassin's Creed. It was wild working with her. She's so knowledgeable. We got to, you know, name different species and we got to give hair commentary, because that was actually one of the first questions that came up, like, in our interviews before we were even accepted onto the team. Zaire and I both took a look at the main character's, like, long, straight black ponytail and went, isn't she jumping in and out of the ocean? How is this going to work? We have questions. How is this working? And the team listened and they revised it and they changed it. So she has braids now, which is way more manageable. But yeah, it was a great experience. So contract is done. Writing's over. Game should be out soon. But it was a wonderful experience. I loved it.
Has your experience working on Subnautica challenged any of the perceptions that you had about game design when you were writing Slay?
Ooh, good question. Not directly. I mean, there were people on the team who were very, like, dedicated to getting things right and dedicated to listening to Zaire and I when we had concerns. So that was really, really cool to see them, like, championing for us and saying, like, if we're going to write a story about two black women in space, like, we really need to get black writers behind this. I mean, that was something I didn't expect, because you always hear about, like, these all-white teams, these all-male teams, you know, trying to write these characters that are diverse, and then it just falling horribly flat. Like, I think what recently happened, my husband was playing Hell something. It came out this year.
What's it about?
It's like a Dark Souls. I forgot what it's called. It's for people who love Dark Souls. And in this game, there is a character who is coded Native American, just generic, no mention of a tribe or anything, giant red headdress, and his name is Tribal.
Oh.
And I was like, oh no. So yeah, this team did a great job of avoiding major pitfalls like that without our input. So
is it Hellpoint?
Hellpoint, that's the one. Yeah.
Oh my goodness.
He called me in the room. He was like, come look at this. Yeah.
That's interesting, because I've spoken to a lot of people about this. The idea that comes up a lot in discussions about representation in video games of whether it's quote unquote okay for some people to write characters that are from different backgrounds than their own. For example, men writing stories about lesbians, or cis writers writing stories about trans characters, or white writers writing black characters. Where do you land on that?
Good question. So if it's the story of a main character who is of a marginalization that's different from you, or specifically is from a marginalization that has historically been oppressed by, like, the privilege of your group, what, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
I wouldn't go there. Just, you know, personally, I don't think I would ever write a story starring, like, a trans person, just because there are so many, like, millions of different angles that I just wouldn't know to write about. And I feel like the character wouldn't be authentic. I would have no idea what I'm doing. It's just, I would have to take literally a lifetime of coursework to really understand any trans experience, let alone several million different trans experiences, to amalgamate them all into one that sums up transness. So I wouldn't feel comfortable with it. I don't advise other authors to do it. With regard to, like, inclusivity and representation, I feel like that's going to be where the best impact is. So, for example, in Slay, Jaylen's character, I felt comfortable writing her character, including her, specifically because with Slay, I knew the question would come up, like, are people of all genders accepted in this world? And I knew I wanted to come in with a big stamp that said, yes. So I felt it did more good than harm, but I made sure as I was writing her character, I wasn't writing it prescriptively. Like, I wasn't writing, you know, this is how to make a trans person feel included in an online gaming space. I wasn't writing, you know, this is the experience of trans people in an online gaming space. I made it very clear this is a very specific case. You know, I didn't go super deep into what this person's experience as a trans person are, only insofar as it relates to the game. So I feel like those kinds of things, just normalizing the existence of marginalized people, is a big enough impact. And that's kind of where I feel like staying in my lane is important. I feel like that's within my lane, and the prescriptive stuff is way outside of it.
What would you like to see for the future of video games as far as telling stories about Black characters or just having Black characters in them?
I mean, I would love to have Black characters in video games as the stars, as the sidekicks, as the villains, just effortlessly without making it like a huge production, which I feel like can really only be achieved if you have people of various backgrounds at all levels in the game, because then it will just naturally come out. You know, you'll naturally have hair that works in the game. You'll naturally have artwork that doesn't look strange on darker skin tones. Everything will, you know, should flow more seamlessly. I'd love for it to be more effortless. I feel like most of the, like, the token Black characters are pretty similar in games, and I feel like there's so many of us out there. we shouldn't be dealing with that at this point. Like, so yeah, I think hiring at every level would be fantastic. You know, hiring marginalized voices, hiring people of all genders at different levels, and then listening to those people when they're brought onto the team.
So, as well as a baby, you have also got another book on the way. Can you tell me a bit about that?
I do. So it's a book called The Cost of Knowing, and it is about two Black teenage brothers. One can see into the future and one can see into the past. And the oldest brother, who can see into the future, sees a vision of his younger brother dying in the next few days. And so it becomes a race against time to get rid of this 400-year-old family curse and reconcile between, like, the anxiety of the future and the regrets of the past. It talks about Black boys and men and their mental health, what is expected of them when we ask for joyful Black boys, and what a tall order that is, and why. It's an invitation to Black men in general into, like, a safe space of talking about their mental health in a way that's intersectional that I haven't seen in the past. I feel like they've been boxed out of those conversations. It was cathartic to write because it's talking about, you know, feeling sandwiched between the future and the past as a Black person trying to live in the present, which is also a scary place lately. It talks about just Black malehood in ways that I feel like Slate literally didn't have the pages for. So it's something I'm really, really proud of, and I'm excited to share with everyone. It comes out March 16th, and it's available for pre-order.
Awesome. It sounds like the kind of thing you should pitch to Don't Nod.
I know, right? I was actually thinking that as I was writing it. I was like, oh, I want to write for Life is Strange one day. I have so many ideas. Yeah.
I mean, it sounds perfect. I'm sure they're looking for their next big story. So you should get in touch.
You should tell them to hit me up.
I will. If you work at Don't Nod and want to hire Brittany to write your next game, you can find her on Twitter at Brittany M. Morris. That's Brittany with two T's, M. Morris with two R's. I'm at Jerrica Weber, and you can follow the podcast at Talking Sim Pod. If you want to get in touch with more than 280 characters, you can even email us at talkingsimulatorpod@gmail.com. Though if you just want to shower us with praise, it's probably better to do that via a 5-star review on Apple Podcasts. And make sure you subscribe so you know when the next episode is live. Our music is by Jazz Mickle. You can find her at Jazz Mickle. Talking Simulator is edited by Leamington's loveliest audio person, Dan Parks. If you need to make something sound good, you can find him at Dan C. Parks. I'm Jordan Erica Weber. Talk again soon.
Normally I would jump in with like what games I've been playing lately, but like lately I've been playing the Decorate the Nursery game. So